Thank you. Thank you very much. I thought it would be appropriate to read. This is a big history crowd, isn't it? The march has many characters, about a dozen major characters in my view, but I thought I'd concentrate on General Sherman, not only because he's historically verifiable, but because at the end of his life, he lived right around the corner on 71st Street. I don't know if you knew that. They were living in St. Louis. He and Mrs. Sherman, their older son, went to Yale, enrolled at Yale, and so they moved east and lived at 75 West 71st Street for the last 2 years of his life. Those of you who have little children probably know about the playground nearby, here on the west side in Central Park, named the William Tecumseh Sherman Playground. It's a rather peculiar name for a playground. But nevertheless, it's there. I'm sure someday someone will mount a campaign to change the name. Maybe the George W. Bush Playground. Well, anyway, about 20 years ago, I picked up a history of Sherman's March by a historian named Joseph Glathar, entitled The March to the Sea and Beyond. And it discussed the event topically, the composition of Sherman's army, camp life, foraging, the battles, the topography, a lot of documentation of the letters and diary entries of no ordinary soldiers. And I remember thinking that the march might serve as an armature for a novel. And over the years, it sat in my mind not as a devastating military campaign only, with 60,000 Union troops wreaking havoc through Georgia and the Carolinas, but as the calamitous displacement of an entire culture. Nothing like it had ever been seen on this continent, and nothing like it would be seen again except perhaps for Hurricane Katrina. As a military operation, it destroyed the Confederacy's capacity to wage war. But as I imagine it, in its cumulative effect, with thousands of freed slaves and dispossessed whites attaching themselves to it, the march would have had to become a superseding reality, a nomadic life form with the power to transform the identities of its participants. And but I didn't do anything about it. You know, we all have ideas in my mind. We carry ideas in our minds, and most of them should stay there. But every once in a while, one of them presses forward. And what happened about three or four years ago is that I happened to run across a photograph of Sherman and his staff posing in front of a field tent. And that set me off. It's a mysterious moment when an idea for a book suddenly coheres and you're off and running. At the end, of course, the battling in this war transcended any cause or principle of right or wrong, because at its climax, all the constraints of civilized behavior went up in flames. Anyway, I'll pick up Sherman as he's approaching Savannah, Georgia. Sherman's glasses were turned on Fort McAllister, which guarded Savannah from the south, a formidably risen parapeted earthwork with a ravine before it and obstructions of abatis made of felled oak trees and chevaux de frise whose stripped branches had been honed into sharp spikes. It was late in the afternoon. He stood with Morrison, his signal officer, atop a mill roof on the left bank of the river a mile or two distant. Above them on a crow's nest hurriedly constructed by the engineers was Morrison's signalman, who was in communication with one of Admiral Dahlgren's squadron laying at anchor in Osibor Sound. So the Navy was there with the clothing and shoes, provisions and mail that the men had been yearning for these many weeks, but it couldn't come up the river till the fort was taken. Entrenched in a great arc of siege in the swampland south and west of the city, Sherman's 14th, 20th, 17th, and 15th Corps were hunkered down in the pooling sumps of canal, water, and sand. His men were cold and miserable and hungry, having marched through a barren, sandy territory that devolved into waterlogged rice plantations where there was no forage to be had. They couldn't light fires to warm themselves lest they invite grapeshot from the rebel guns. Miles behind them was the wagon train with the hardtack and coffee and beef on the hoof, but nothing could move forward into this chilled, watery lowland until the city was taken. "Your division will storm Fort McAllister," Sherman had told General Hazen. "I won't fuddle about. I've come this far and my army wants its prize. We take McAllister and we'll have Savannah." Now he saw Hazen's regiment moving into position through the woods and halting at its edge. "Signal Admiral Dahlgren, the assault is about to begin," Sherman said. "Then order Hazen to begin." "Yes, let it begin," Sherman said. Within moments, the blue lines appeared in parade at the edge of the open land and began their advance. A quick trot, arms at the ready, through the fields in the late afternoon sun toward the fort some 800 yards away. Rebel Napoleons immediately boomed forth their round shot. The lines he saw now were converging from three directions, north, south, and along the capital, colors flying. "My God, they're magnificent," Sherman cried. Within moments, the smoke of the big guns enveloped the scene like fog drift, and the wind brought to Sherman the pungency of blown powder. And now only the caprices of the wind would let him see discrete moments of the action, tantalizing glimpses as if he thought the smoke were the diaphanous dance veil of the war goddess. "And I'm seduced," Sherman said aloud to a startled Morrison. Yet even from these glimpses, Sherman saw things that assured him the assault would succeed. The rebels had left fallen trees in the field where his men could take cover and return fire, and the big guns were without embrasures. His sharpshooters would kill the artillerists, and as he listened, the tempo of shot and shell seemed to slow. The white smoke of the battle began to lift, and now he could see his men clambering up the glacis from the ravine, some of them blown into the air by torpedo mines embanked there. But the blue lines came on, more and more of them, and the parapet was gained. He could see the fighting hand to hand. Sherman had to lower his glass to overcome, to watch. He loved a brave man. Regiments of them brought sobs of joy. How many minutes later it was when Captain Morrison called out, "It's ours, sir, I see the colors." And it was true. All at once, the firing ceased, and they heard a great shout over the field. And through his glass, Sherman saw his men waving their fists and firing their muskets into the sky. It was dark when Sherman arrived at the fort. He made his inspection and complimented the defending commander, a young major who admitted that he had not expected an attack so late in the day. The moon had risen, throwing a chill white light over the dead who lay where they had fallen. But among them lay his own sleeping soldiers. Sherman's men had found foodstuffs and wine in the cellars, and now they slept. Sitting with crossed legs on a barrel, a cigar in one hand and a cup of wine in the other, Sherman contemplated how matter-of-factly his men accepted the dead, that they could lie down so casually beside them, all of them asleep, though some forever. He barely noticed the coat thrown around his shoulders by his servant, Moses Brown. His thoughts ran this way. What if the dead man dreams as the sleeper dreams? How do we know there is not a posthumous mind, or that death is not a dream state from which the dead can't awaken? And so they are trapped in the hideous universe of such looming terrors as I have known in my nightmares. The only reason to fear death is that it's not a true, insensible end of consciousness. That is the only reason I fear death. In fact, we don't know what it is other than a profound humiliation. We're not made to appreciate it. As a general officer, I consider the death of one of my soldiers first and foremost a numerical disadvantage, an entry into the liability column. That is all my description of it. It is a utilitarian idea of death, that I am reduced by one in my ability to fight a war. Each man has a life and a spirit and the habits of thought and person that define him. But en masse, he's uniformed over. And whatever he may think of himself, I think of him as a weapon. And perhaps we call a private, for whatever he is to himself, it is private to him and of no use to the general. And so a generalship diminishes the imagination of a general. But these troops, too, who have battled and eaten and drunk and fallen asleep with some justifiable self-satisfaction, what is their imagination of death? Who can lie down with it? They are no more appreciative of its meaning than I. And so, who is left but the ladies? Perhaps they know. They bring life into being. Perhaps they know what it is as afterlife. But often they talk of heaven and hell. I take no stock in such ideas as heaven or hell. And fate? In war, fate is altogether incidental. In fact, it is nothing as awesome as fate if you happen to raise your head in the path of a cannonball. That nigger who was killed the other day by the railroad track not 10 yards from me, I saw the ball coming, a 32-pound round shot, and I shouted. But as he turned, it bounced up from the ground and took off his head. That was not fate. There are too many missiles in the air for it to be your fate to be killed by one of them, just as the number of men set to fighting deem any of their deaths of no great moment. In this war among the states, why should the reason for fighting count for anything? For if death doesn't matter, why should life matter? But of course, I can't believe this or I'll lose my mind. Willie, my son, Willie, oh, my son. Shall I say his life didn't matter to me, and the thought of his body lying in its grave terrifies me no less to think he is not imprisoned in his dreams as he is in his coffin. It is insupportable in any event. It is in fear of my own death, whatever it is, that I would wrest immortality from the killing war I wage. I would live forever down the generations. And so the world in its belief snaps back into place. Yes, there is now Savannah to see to. I will invest it and call for its surrender. I have a cause, I have a command, and what I do well, and God help me, but I'm thrilled to be praised by my peers and revered by my countrymen. There are men and nations, there is right and wrong, there is this union, and it mustn't fail. Sherman drank off his wine and flung the cup over the entrenchment. He lurched to his feet and peered every which way in the moonlight. But where is my drummer boy? He said. Now we'll move forward in time, skip over the events of many other characters. And Sherman is settled in Savannah. In the first triumphant days of the occupation, Sherman had sent a telegram to the president. I beg to present to you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah, with 150 heavy guns and plenty of ammunition, and also about 25,000 bales of cotton. He held in his hands Lincoln's letter of humble thanks, an adoring note from Grant, a copy of the congressional resolution in his honor, editorials fulsome in their acclaim. The country had gone wild. The general, whom nobody had heard from in months, had buried an axe in the southern heart. Sherman's billet was the mansion of a cotton broker. Its many rooms were hushed by thick rugs and heavy draperies. There were potted palms and busts of Roman senators on pedestals. The walls were hung with paintings of pink-nippled harem women lolling under the eyes of Negro eunuchs. He slept little. In his apartments upstairs, he sat in his bath and smoked his cigar and read of his greatness. Letters of adulation were coming in by the bundle. He called for Moses Brown to add to the hot water, for that was the only thing that could calm him now, national recognition working in him as a nervous excitement. Also, the steam eased his breathing. His asthma was acting up. Not only the rain, but the sea wind was having its effect. Sherman came from Ohio. Even to be near the sea unsettled him. And whenever he had to be on it, all he could think of was the perversity of God in composing something that only heaved and wallowed and slopped about. He wrote to his wife, "I will not trust this acclaim to last. Are these not the newspapers that after Shiloh announced to the world that I was crazy? It is the verso of the same coin. Yet day and night, crowds of blacks stood outside the house waiting for a glimpse of him. By 8 every morning, petitioners were lined up in the parlor. Periodically, he went downstairs to receive them. Among his visitors were the wives of Confederate generals. They brought letters from their husbands asking that they be given safe passage. He readily complied. He affected gallantry. He wanted the people of Savannah to know that he was, despite all reports, human. The women were the hardest to convince. The older they were, the more likely they were to let him know what they thought of him. In a way, he found this salutary. A Mrs. Letitia Pettibone appeared, whom he vaguely remembered from his days as a young officer stationed in Atlanta. What she said he couldn't recall later, for she carried a beaded purse looped to her wrist, and when she swung it at him, had he not with his quick reflexes stepped back, he was a certain casualty of war. After the woman was escorted from the room, he took a puff of his cigar and said to his adjutant, "A new field order, Morrison. Ladies will please check their handbags at the door." Christmas morning, the rain poured from a black sky. Sherman had called for a review of the troops. His remarks for this occasion were written out for company commanders to read to their men. While they stood on parade, the troops heard that they would be remembered in the military history of the world. Sherman, on the reviewing platform, listened to his words coming disynchronously from all directions as if through water. The tarpaulin roof over his head billowed and snapped in the wind. Two regimental bands combined played a march. It sounded as if every note was played twice. Sherman considered again the measures he had taken. The Ogeechee River and the Sound cleared of mines. Secesh coastal guns dismounted. Slocum's corps deployed from the Savannah River to the 7 mile post on the canal. Howard's to the sea. Kilpatrick's cavalry by the King's Bridge and the roads leading north and west. Shops open, streets cleared, fire companies intact. All public buildings abandoned, plantations, etc. The property of the federal government. He'd missed nothing. Then what was wrong? The national praise heaped on him in the past several days seemed as cold and wet as the rain on his face. Is that all? Is that all it is, this damn weather in my lungs? He left the platform and was ridden to his rooms. Sitting facing a warm hearth, his feet in their damp socks held before the fire, Sherman began to work it out. None of this of Savannah was war. It was governance. Warring in the field was pure, clear of purpose. It had a form. But governance was conferring with civil authorities. It was dealing with northern recruiting agents who wanted to conscript blacks as army substitutes. It was dodging ladies' handbags. The local population was swollen with whites who fled here along with the freed slaves who had trailed after the columns. He was feeding them all, white and black. The port was thick with packets and steamers and cutters. The city was rife with unattached and bereft women of childbearing age. His soldiers were gambling, and those who were not in the whorehouses were filling the churches. He'd ordered drills and installed curfews, but none of it could staunch the drip-by-drip depletion of their war blood. It was as if the fighting force of Sherman had melted and spread over Savannah, like some viscid pool of humanity. Somewhere in all of this, there must still be an army, Sherman said to himself. Where are they when I need them? Until I get out of here, I'm a sitting duck for Washington. At this moment, Major Morrison entered the room with the message that Secretary of War Edwin Stanton was arrived in port on a revenue cutter. So does the laurel wither, Sherman thought. What will Stanton say? That I let a Confederate force of 10,000 men slip away into South Carolina? The human capacity for gratitude is limited. Inside the gratitude is envy. Inside the envy is the indifference of a heedless world. The secretary's carriage rolling to a stop under the porte cochere, the honor guard presented arms. Stanton was second only to the president in authority. But in Sherman's eyes, the man stepping down was a portly figure whose soft face with its plump cheeks bespoke a constitution that would not survive a day's march. General, he said, and gave Sherman a limp hand. That concluded the amenities. Stanton began speaking even before they were in the door. He had a lot on his mind. His stiff forked beard rose and fell with his words. Sherman, entranced by the brandished beard, missed a good deal. Something about how the blacks had been treated. So that was it. I would meet with your general officers, Stanton said. At dinner, Sherman produced his wing and corps commanders. They were an imposing sight, decked out in their ceremonial swords, gauntlets, and sash. But they sat as stiffly as school children while Stanton walked around the table as if conducting a lesson. I'm not sure, gentlemen, of your army's appropriate conduct regarding the freed slaves, he said. My understanding is that they were discouraged from accompanying the forces, that they were sent back to their masters or left as prey to guerrillas. The men looked at Sherman, slouched in his chair with a severe frown on his brow. Mr. Secretary, Sherman said, how do you expect me to march 60,000 fighting men through enemy country with the weight of the entire slave population of Georgia on their backs? As it is, the darkies seem to be here, as you will see if you look out the window. You have refused to enlist them in your army except as menial laborers. As laborers is the way they are best used. There is one report of an incident at Ebenezer Creek, was it? Your General Davis, who pulled up the bridge and left hundreds behind to die, some of them drowned, some of them were slaughtered by guerrillas. Where is he? Where is this general? He's on duty. I will have him summoned. I will hear from him his explanation, and you will be satisfied of the military necessity of his action. In the morning, the cavalry had to be brought in for parade. The secretary stood with his belly pressed against the cast iron railing of the balcony outside Sherman's apartments and watched unsmiling as the horsemen passed in the street below him. Kilpatrick rode as their head, a Beau Brummel in his gold sash and braid, peeking from under his plumed hat with a sly smile. His slight figure seeming to pose with some insolence, Sherman thought, or was it his bobbing hunchback that conveyed his attitude? Kill is a reckless fool. He enjoys war too much. He makes camp in women's bedrooms, but I wouldn't trade him for anything. By the third day of the visit, Sherman wondered how much longer he would be able to hold his temper. The secretary didn't talk. He fulminated. He was like a spoiled child and was always in need of something, a drink, a hot water bottle, a telegrapher. Behind everything the secretary said or did was a desire for attention. Sherman had wanted the captured cotton for the Army Exchequer. Stanton countermanded it for the Treasury. He had strong views on who should garrison the city. He presumed to advise Sherman on strictly military matters. And then came his demand to meet with some Negro elders. He was impatient until they were rounded up from the black churches. When they were gathered in the parlor, he asked them what they understood by slavery. And black men looked at one another and smiled. Slavery is receiving by irresistible power the work of another man, not by his consent, one of them said. And the others nodded their agreement. And what, said Stanton, do you understand of the freedom that was to be given by the proclamation of President Lincoln? The freedom promised by the proclamation is taking us from under the yoke of bondage and placing us where we can reap the fruits of our own labor and take care of ourselves and assist the government in maintaining our freedom. Sherman hid his astonishment at how well-spoken these blacks were. At that moment, Stanton turned to him. General, he said, I will now confer with these freedmen regarding the colored people's feeling toward yourself. Would you mind leaving the room for a moment? Sherman was livid. He paced the hallway, muttering to himself, to catechize these blacks regarding my character. How would any of them be here if not for me? 10,000 are free and fed and clothed by my orders. That they are not fighting is my best military judgment, nor have I had the leisure to train them. I have marched an army intact for 400 miles. I have gutted Johnny Reb's railroads. I have burned his cities, his forges, his armories, his machine shops, his cotton gins. I have eaten his crops out. I have consumed his livestock and appropriated 10,000 of his horses and mules. He is left ravaged and destitute, and even if not another battle is fought, his forces must wither and die of attrition. And that is not enough for the Secretary of War. I must abase myself to the slaves. Damn this Stanton. I am sworn to destroy the treasonous insurrection and preserve the Union. That's all, and that's everything. Sherman was hardly mollified to hear that he was held in high favor by the black elders. Later that night, he called in Morrison. The fellow had been sleeping. Your pen, Major, get this down. Field order, whatever it is. It would be number 15, sir. Number 15, he said. The Sea Islands from Charleston south and all the abandoned plantation acreage along the rivers for 30 miles inland in South Carolina, and I'll throw in parts of Georgia and the county bordering on the St. John's River in Florida, are reserved for black resettlement. Have you got that? Black resettlement. Every free Negro head of family is to be given title to 40 acres of tillable ground, yes, and the seed and equipment to farm them. All boundaries to be determined and possessory titles issued by a general officer of the U.S. Army as, call him Inspector of Settlements and Plantations, yes, and tidied up for my signature with a copy from Mr. Stanton. I am no abolitionist, Sherman thought, but with this enticement, I both shut up Edwin Stanton and disengage the niggers who will stay to plant their 40 acres, and God help them. To celebrate the Secretary's departure, Sherman had a dinner for his generals. It was as if they all needed to regain their dignity. Everyone was jolly. They were themselves again. Sherman sat at the head of a long table while the black waiters marched in with the pillage of the city. Platters of oysters, roasted turkeys, baked hams, steaming mounds of seasoned rice, platters of sweet potatoes, loaves of warm bread, and salvers of real butter, hampers of red wine. Sherman ate and drank and offered toasts, but he wanted to be on the march again where nobody could tell him what to do. He wanted to be back in the field. What could be better than lying on the hard ground each night and gazing up at the stars? What could be better than setting out each morning to run your war the way it ought to be run? The issues were unambiguous. The demands were clear. He had enough of Savannah and its glory. The real glory was in the uncommunicable joy of doing well what God had deemed for you. There was no envy there, no praise to explode in your face. Gentlemen, Sherman announced, we've had enough of these fleshpots. Tomorrow we begin preparations for the new campaign. You all know what it is. We have Grant's leave to take the Carolinas. It'll be hard, no mistake. Georgia was no more than a hayride. We must divest ourselves of surplus horses, mules, and Negroes. We must pare ourselves down to our fighting essence. The terrain is forbidding. The match will be arduous. But I assure you the infamous state of South Carolina as instigator of our war will have never have known the meaning of devastation until it feels the terrible swift sword of this army. Hear, hear, the generals raised their glasses. At the end of the evening, Sherman went to his room, mellow with wine and feeling more relaxed than he had in days. He was humming the overture to the Flying Dutchman. Some newspapers were newly arrived from Ohio, his home. He lit a cigar, and expecting to amuse himself with the local gossip, he sat back and read in the Columbus, Ohio Times that Charles Sherman, the six-month-old son of General and Mrs. William Tecumseh Sherman, had died of the croup. His hands dropped to his sides. Oh, Lord, he cried, is the envy yours as well? I guess I'll stop there.
We're going to try out the questions by my repeating your question to Mr. Doctorow. And if he happens to hear you very well, then I'll just step down and go back to my seat. So do you want to pick the first questioner?
Yeah.
Okay.
As long as it's easy.
Okay. How is it easy? Okay.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about punctuation and what it's like. I don't know if that's an easy question or not, but what it's like writing without the dialogue punctuated in the way that we normally find it in novels. It was a challenge to read. I eventually came to like it, but I'm assuming writing that way is also different. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Did you hear?
Yeah. Why? Well,
maybe I'll step down and.
All right.
Just call me up if
okay,
you need.
Okay. I will. Madam, I first stopped using quotation marks around speech in 1975 in a book called Ragtime. What I discovered then, that they were very messy. They left a lot of spots on a page. And I realized that if I was doing my job correctly, the reader would always know that someone was speaking. And if I was really good, the reader would know who it was who was speaking. And it seemed to work out to my satisfaction, and I've never used punctuation of that kind again. Now, if you're talking about my run-on sentences, no, just the quotation mark. Okay. Generally speaking, I found that when I'm transgressing, the work is good. When you're breaking laws, when you're doing things you shouldn't be doing, it usually is going to work out nicely. Yes?
Well, I loved the book, and I also noted the punctuation. It didn't bother me, and I thought it was really well done. But my question is, because as you're reading it, I mean, you're reading something that's historical fact. So you're always curious what is actual fact and what is fiction as far as the characters. For example, the surgeon from Germany, did you read about this man and built him as a character into the story? And are there any other characters, non-military names, which of course would be the fact, that you read about and you built in to the fiction part of the story?
Well, as far as what is a historical fact and what isn't, you want to know how much research I do? Just enough. When you look at a painter's portrait of somebody, you don't usually ask if it's factual or not. You ask if it's good. When you take an historically verifiable character like Sherman and you write him, you're doing what the painter does who paints a portrait. The painter doesn't just paint, the good painter, what he sees. He paints what he thinks, or what he thinks he sees. And there's always a judgment in every portrait. And it's laid down in color and composition, a distance from the character, and so on. There were court painters who were commissioned by kings and queens and royalty, like Van Dyck, who nevertheless got around that, presumably painting as favorably as they could the subject, but who managed to get in a view that was very often on the border of mockery or irreverence. Now, the third part of your rather complex question had to do with the character of Reed Sartorius, the German immigrant, a colonel in the army, brilliant surgeon. He appeared as a character in an earlier book of mine called The Waterworks. At a later moment in his life, during the regime of Boss Tweed in New York City, when his scientific brilliance and experimentation had carried him past morally justifiable levels. But during that book, I mentioned in his earlier life, he was an accomplished surgeon who brought new procedures and techniques to the Army. So I figured when I started to write this book that it was only fair to show him at an earlier stage of his life. Yes.
Two minutes ago, you gave the quote regarding punctuation that most of the time when you do things you're not supposed to do, they turn out okay. Would you apply that same standard to the life of Sherman?
For what?
Doing things you're not supposed to do, they turn out okay.
You want more examples?
No. No. Would you apply that standard
to the life of
Sherman?
Life of whom?
Sherman.
This must be the New York Historical Society. I thought I answered that, but this is my Sherman. It's based on, the events, the facts, the situations he's in are all, can all be verified if you, you might even read his own memoirs. He wrote a great book, his memoirs. He and Grant are the best writing generals in the history of the country. We haven't had a general who could write like these guys could since. And I drew from that. I created my Sherman from that. When I started using historical characters, it was with Ragtime 30 years ago. And a lot of people were very upset by that. And I didn't understand why they were upset. Of course, it was a naughty book. It was impertinent and satirical in places, and it had a kind of a mock historical chronicle quality and dwelled in, had a little fun with the erotic stuff. But when I was growing up and reading, people were doing this. Homer did it. Can't go much further back than that. Shakespeare, of course. Do you know there is a King Richard III Society that's determined to recover the reputation of King Richard III from what Shakespeare did to it? And I hope they succeed, and then we'll have their Richard and Shakespeare's Richard. Now, Leo Tolstoy has Napoleon as a character, and it's a vicious portrait. He has him as a fat little fellow with putting snuff up his nose and unable to sit astride a horse properly and being very temperamental and girlish. It's a savage portrait. And that's Tolstoy's Napoleon. There are many others. I'm not finished. Well, you're asking me to tell you whether what Sherman did.
What you thought of the things he did, which weren't right, came out okay.
You want my opinion of General Sherman's career and campaign? Is that it? See me after class. Yes.
I was moved to tears by one paragraph in the book, and that was where the surgeon is on the battlefield, and he is treating soldiers from both sides. And I'd like to know, was that true, and is that the usual?
Everything in this book is true. Every word. Every missing quotation mark.
Do you see all of your books as occupying one world that you had, like the birth of Coalhouse Walker in March, originating in Ragtime, and you had mentioned The Surgeon also?
One world?
Like that they all, that the characters in your different books interact, that as historical fiction, even though they all take place at different times, that the characters that you invent like live throughout the different time periods which your books take place in?
Oh, that's a good question. People have always told me that one book is astonishingly different from another. I've never believed that. And I always have thought that I have a repertory company of characters. And they're very reliable, and their costumes change with each book, and their makeup. But they're my people. If I understand your question correctly also, in terms of the relation of the books, when you write, you cannot know too well what you're doing. So you get a degree of self-consciousness and you're dead in the water. So it wasn't until my third or fourth book that my editor said, you know, you tend to set your novels in the past. And I hadn't realized that. And nor have I ever had in mind a saga of American history. But in fact, someone told me, well, you can start with the march and then read the waterworks, which takes place after the war in New York in the 1870s, and then go on to Ragtime, which is the turn of the century. And then there are a few books about the 1930s, the World's Fair, Billy Bathgate, Loon Lake. And then probably you would want to read the Book of Daniel, which goes from the 30s to the 60s. And then maybe City of God, which is contemporary. And you have covered 150 years of one man's vision of American history. Well, when he told me that, I got very depressed. So I mean, that's one way to look at these books, but I wouldn't look at them that way. But I didn't let him know that I was upset. I always tend to agree with any reasonable interpretation of my work, as long as it doesn't claim to be exhaustive. People will say, you're a political novelist, aren't you? All right, yeah. And you write a lot about history, so you're kind of a political, historical novelist. It's all right, you can get away with that. And you seem to have a lot of children in your books, don't you? Yeah, that's right, I do. And you're Jewish, aren't you? Jewish? So you're a Jewish novelist. Right, I am. And it goes on like that. And I always agree. I always agree. But the historical idea gives me far more credit than I deserve.
I love your books, I love your humor, I love your warmth. My question really is about your creative process. What do you go through emotionally in giving birth to these beautiful books? And what was the roughest period that you ever went through as a writer, creatively?
My roughest period. when I was writing the Book of Daniel, which is about a based on the loosely based on the Rosenberg case in the 1950s, when this couple were accused of giving the secrets of the atom bomb to the Soviets, and they were put on trial and convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage, but they were really regarded as treasonous people and communists, and the judge sentenced them to death, and they died in the electric chair. And my problem, I had originally thought of about radical behavior in this country and the difference between radicals from the 1930s and the radicals then going, coming up in, when I was thinking about this book, in the late 60s. So it was a difference between the old left and the new left, the one being European Marxist, Stalinist, intellectually, theoretically organized, and the other being anarchistic, spontaneous, non-theoretical, certainly at the beginning. And I was trying to figure out how to connect, tell the story of 30 years of American life, my country's life, using the radicals. And the fulcrum, as I figured out, the story I needed was that story of the couple. They would be the fulcrum between the two ages, and they would have children. And I started to write the book, and I did 150 pages, and I read them one. You know, the time you take to read what you've written, every 100 pages, so a very critical time, very serious day in the work. And I read these 150 pages, and I was bored. They were terrible. I said to myself, if I take material like this and make it boring, I have no right to be a writer. And I threw the pages across the room, and I really hit bottom. At that moment, I sat down, I put another sheet of paper in the typewriter. We used typewriters in those days. And I start to write what turned out to be the first page of the Book of Daniel. And what it took me this awful moment to learn was that I shouldn't write the book. Daniel should write it. Should be from his point of view. And once I had that voice, I sailed along. So that was one of my rough moments. What was the other part of your question? The creative process? Is that what you... Well, it's very noble work, you know. Almost heroic. The last person in the world to ask about the creative process is a person who is carried along by it. It's very strange and mysterious. People have theories. Henry James has a wonderful essay called The Art of Fiction, which you should read. And he says it's like taking vibrations from the air and composing words from them. And he posits, I'll paraphrase roughly, if you had a young woman who'd led a very sheltered life, walking past an army barracks and hearing just a phrase or two coming out of soldiers' conversation, she could, if she were a novelist, go home and write a perfectly credible novel about army life. Taking what James calls seeing the unseen, seeing the unseen, taking the barest hint, the smallest evocative impulse, and creating a whole world about around it. Most of my novels have begun from images that I didn't understand that were in my mind. Like Billy Bathgate, for some reason I had in my mind an image of men in black ties standing on a tugboat at a dock in the East River. And I thought it was so strange, a workboat with men in black tie, formal clothes. What were they doing there? So I wrote the book to find out. Theodore Dreiser was a reporter, and one of his friends challenged him to a novel writing contest. So he agreed to do that and wrote down the word Sister Carrie. He had no idea what he meant, and he wrote the novel to find out. I hope that really confuses you. Writers have different theories. Saul Bellow said he sometimes felt like a medium. Mark Twain said, I never write a book unless it writes itself, or words to that effect. So we're totally unreliable as reporters about this strange irrational activity of ours.
In terms of the field research for this book, did you drive Sherman's March and walk parts of it?
I did not follow his march. I did not. Probably most of it is now interstates. But I have spent a lot of time in the South. I did some training in Georgia when I was in the Army, and they did me the pleasure of destroying my hearing. That was in Georgia. And I happen to have married a Southern woman, too. And but the point is, there's a lot of documentation, and the idea is to do as little walking as you possibly get away with. Yes, sir.
What do you think of the film versions of your works, and do you see this being made into a movie? What do you think of the film versions of your previous works, and do you see this being made into a film?
I'm a four-time loser. Actually, one of the pictures has my respect. It's the film that Sidney Lumet made of Daniel. I wrote the screenplay for that. We were sort of partners, and we were in the cutting room together. We made some serious mistakes. There's some brilliant scenes in that movie. It's one of the great commercial disasters of our time. Ragtime is a long, boring story, but late Robert Altman was supposed to direct, and we got together, and I knew he was known for departing from his screenplays, so I wrote a 400-page screenplay. Most screenplays are about 100, 120 pages long. But I wrote a little over 400 pages because I figured whatever he would do, he would not get out of my book. To my astonishment, he decided to film all 420 pages. This was before Roots or a miniseries or anything like that. He wanted to do 2 3-hour theatrical films and throw in another 4 hours for eventual television production. When the producer heard that, he fired Altman right off the picture. They'd had some other problems. So then this other guy came along, Milos Forman, and wanted me to write his idea. And most directors I've worked with, I call the theory of the one disastrous idea. And Forman's one disastrous idea was that a movie should be about one person. And there he was with Ragtime in his hands. And I said, well, why did you accept this job? So I refused to write anymore. I wanted to move on. And he made his movie. The thing about movies is that they're the enemy. people talk about film language. That's an oxymoron. It was Altman who said to me, by the time I set the scene and place the camera where I'm going to put it and dress the characters and give them makeup and fix their hair, he says, hair is very important in movies. You don't realize how important hair is. It gives you someone's status, education, age. Hair is really a significant visual hint of a person. He said, by the time you do all that and direct their eyes and their gestures and everything, throw in some music, light the scene, 98% of the meaning of that scene is delivered before anyone says a word. So if it is language, it's hieroglyphic language. I thought we were finished with that 3,000 years ago. Movies, they think they can do everything. I think words do everything. If I want to make it rain, I have a wonderful tool. It's the word rain, R-A-I-N. It's very inexpensive. If Milos Forman wants to rain, he brings in a rain machine. It costs $60,000 a day. Producers used to say, I brought this picture in for X number of dollars. Brought this picture in for $120 million. So I figured out what I brought Ragtime in for, the novel, or the march, for that matter. I used about 6 pounds of coffee, a printer, cartridges, several of those, a few reams of paper. I brought in the march for $64.